Today, I had the golden opportunity to talk with Sheldon Dingwall of Dingwall Guitars. Dingwall basses are known for their revolutionary design, their tight low end, and the fan frets. I really enjoyed talking to Sheldon, and I hope you like it too. Here's my interview. Sheldon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to Holland. Because for the people viewing, we are in the Netherlands at the moment, in a small town called Krimpen aan de Lek. It's very close to Rotterdam. Before we kick off, what is your connection to Holland?
Well, this is my first time here, but in Canada, there's quite a large Dutch population. Many moved over in the 50s. I'm not sure why, but they all
labor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Farming.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's where I met most of them. They were in agriculture.
Yeah.
One of my early mentors who gave me my start with learning how to use heavy-duty machinery was from Holland. And he was originally trained as a chef, but had transitioned into repairing antiques. And he was like the go-to guy for antique repair. And I hung around at his shop, and he took me under his wing and taught me how to grind my own knives to carve necks. Like, when I say knives, I'm talking knives that go on a machine.
Oh, like the big cutters.
Yeah, yeah. And he taught me how to use what's called a shaper. Mm-hmm. And so it was the most interesting experience, because this knife would be about this long, spinning like this, and you'd feed the neck into it, and you'd watch the grain disappear, almost like an MRI of a human body.
Yeah.
This was an MRI of wood, and it was a really interesting experience. Super dangerous. I can still count to 10. I don't know how, because when something goes wrong, it goes wrong at the speed of light, and it's just, a neck could explode right in front of you.
Dangerous.
Very dangerous.
Is it still, do they still use that kind of equipment nowadays?
There are levels as you progress through manufacturing guitars, and you start off with the machinery you can afford, and you learn to use that, and it's a really good experience. And as you gain experience, you start to realize how dangerous this is, and you start to buy safer machinery. These days we use CNC machines. Which, in my opinion, they're just another tool. It's like a different kind of paintbrush that allows you to control things in a different way. But it all comes back to a chisel.
Yeah.
Even though it's high-tech computerized machinery, it's just a chisel that's spinning that's controlled by a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The connection to Holland.
Hmm.
There's a famous Dutch bass player.
Yes.
Who was very much a fan of Dingwall basses. Unfortunately, he's not amongst us anymore. He died, I think, 2 years ago.
Yes.
His name is Henny Vrienten, of the famous Dutch ska band, pop band, called Doe Maar.
Yes.
Have you heard of him?
Yes. He had a Super J, four string. And unfortunately, I never had a chance to meet him. Always wanted to, because I'd only seen him in photos and read about him. And he just seemed like the most elegant gentleman. He kind of reminded me of John McLaughlin. Had that kind of vibe, that very elegant vibe. And would have loved to have met him.
Yeah, I can understand. Yeah. Let's talk about your first recollection of music, guitars in general. What's your first memory?
Very first memory would be, like a lot of drummers, waking up before the rest of the family and crawling into the kitchen and pulling out pots and pans and hitting them with spoons.
Cool.
That was my first memory. Second memory was, I grew up in a musical household. Everyone was a musician. We had a baritone ukulele, and my older sisters had a book and they were studying. I couldn't read. I was too young. And I strummed it and thought, this sounds terrible. And so I retuned it at the age of four to an open chord. And I don't know what the chord was. It was just whatever sounded good, and drove my sisters crazy because they'd pick it up and try and play. And it was like, no, it's supposed to be tuned standard.
Yeah.
And then my third memory, which influenced my career, was being at the piano. And I remember being eye level with the keys. So 4 or 5 years old, and I'd run to one end of the piano and hit the treble keys, and it'd be plink, 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 and I'd run to the other end, and it would just, I remember the richness of the lower notes, and I always loved that sound, just the roll. I'd hold the note and just hear it sustain, and I never forgot that. And later, as I started to build basses or started to investigate basses, that was the most influential experience of my life.
Yeah, the low tones.
Yeah, and pianos.
Yeah, pianos. All right. I heard you say not standard tuning.
Mm-hmm.
And that struck a chord with me about your fanned fret system that you imply on all your basses. Is that something not being standard, maybe a red line, how do you say it, a line throughout your career?
Yeah, you know,
trying to look for other things that work.
For sure, yeah. I don't know if it's an ADD thing or just a creative mindset thing, but the desire to explore and find something that's newer and better, and however, fan frets are multi-scale. They started 3,000 years BC on harps.
Oh yeah,
and harps have been the same way ever since, relatively speaking, long bass strings and short treble strings.
Can you explain for the people who don't know about fan fretism, the multi-year skill system, what it does and what the benefits are?
Sure. Like if you think of a harp or a piano, harps and pianos both cover a wide range of frequencies, from the lowest notes to the highest notes. And if you look at orchestral instruments like the violin family, it takes 4 separate instruments to cover that same range of frequencies. So the double bass, the cello, the viola, and the violin. And if you look at those instruments, they're longer scale, medium scale, shorter scale, and really short scale. And so the idea of having longer and shorter scale lengths in music has been around forever. And it's physically what you have to do to achieve those different ranges. Ralph Novak in the late 80s, and multi-scale is not a new concept either. It kind of came in favor and then went away and came in favor, went away. And then in the 80s, Ralph Novak was trying to create the perfect Les Paul Stratocaster.
Okay.
And everybody was putting a humbucker into a Stratocaster, trying to make it sound like a Les Paul. What did it sound like? It sounded like a Stratocaster with a humbucker.
Yeah.
And Ralph was the first guy to go, well, the beauty of a Les Paul are just these fat treble strings, and the beauty of a Stratocaster are these bright wound strings. The difference is the scale length. Why don't I try just doing Les Paul scale on half the neck and Strat on the other half? And he went to go do that, and he went, oh, wait a minute, I can't bend strings if the frets are half and half. Hmm. Well, I'll just connect them and make them diagonal.
Wow.
And that was all of the thinking that went into it. It was just an experiment. And when he strung up that guitar, so shorter treble strings, longer bass strings, and then the frets just angled to make that work. He tried it for the first time and went, oh my God, this is way better than I expected. And it went on from there.
And when did you, like at Dingle Guitars, implemented it for the first time? Was it like the first thing you did?
No, I started, the first thing I started with was designing and building Floyd Rose style locking trims. Because I couldn't afford one and they weren't available in Canada. So I thought, well, I'll make one. And so I used that on my guitars for several years, toured with them. And then I was building necks and bodies just for myself.
Yeah.
And testing those on the road. And my plan when I decided I'm too old to be a professional musician, it's not going anywhere. I was 24 at the time. but it was the right move for me, because there are musicians and then there are true musicians. And I was a good musician, but I was a long way from being a great musician who could make a living at it.
Okay.
And so my original business plan was just to make a replacement Stratocaster necks. For some reason, necks fascinated me. Still do.
Yeah.
That led to complete guitars. That led to people asking for basses. Five strings with a good sounding B. And that's where I was like, I'm not a bass player. I don't know anything about building basses.
Yeah.
But I know pianos sound good with low Bs. So what are they doing that I could apply to a bass?
Yeah.
And it came down to scale length. So did experiments and realized for what I wanted to hear, what I wanted out of a B string, it required a 37 inch scale. And I thought, well, that's fine. But nobody will want a 37 scale. It's just, it's too long. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd hit a roadblock. And then I was at a luthiers convention where I met Ralph Novak. And, you know, it's interesting when you meet people, you just instantly like them, or maybe you instantly don't feel comfortable. With Ralph, I just instantly liked him. We both felt comfortable. And we talked about how this would be fantastic for bass. And Ralph said, well, you know, I'm more interested in guitars. Why don't you take basses and I'll do guitars? And we shook hands and I went back to Canada. And 6 months later, I had the original design.
Can you remember the first time it was finished and you plugged in for the first time?
Yes. January 13th, 7:30 in the morning. I had a flight to go to NAMM at 9:30, and I'd worked all night finishing the bass, which was common back then. I remember plugging it in, going, sounds amazing. Took the whole bass apart, put it into a case, got on the plane, and off to NAMM.
That was just in time for the NAMM show. I mean,
yes.
Was it like building towards that moment? I have to finish it before NAMM?
Yes. And so that NAMM 1993 company was tiny. We were more focused on repairs at that time just to be able to have an income. And I didn't have a booth at NAMM. And back in those days, you could actually walk in with a guitar and show it to people. You can't do that now.
No.
But so it was absolutely incredibly fortunate. The first musician I bump into was Steve Bailey. And I show him the bass. And Steve was the most incredibly gracious. And he became my NAMM host. And we walked through the entire show together, and he introduced me to Victor Wooten, and he introduced me to Keith Horn and all of his friends. So without that warm welcome, I would have been lost.
I can imagine. Yeah. It's a do or die moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You only have one shot.
Exactly. At that time, Bill and Pat Bartolini, they were like the mom and dad of all the young bass builders. Rob Elric, Ken Lawrence, Lakeland, and us. And so they would let all us young builders who couldn't afford a booth put a bass in their booth.
Oh, and that's so gracious.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it advertised their products, but it gave us this concentrated group of young bass builders. We all hung out together and we're still all friends. But you know, it was a real sort of gestation period for a lot of these small companies.
Mm. Wow. But that's amazing. Nowadays you need to buy a booth, a place at the table.
Yep.
At that time it was a moment for you if you didn't had that chance.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of, you know, on a much smaller scale, kind of like the artists in the 20s in Paris, where they hung out at cafes together and, you know, you feed off each other's creativity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About the production of a bass.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How long does it take when you have an idea for a certain style from like the idea till the moment that it's tested and ready for production? How does that process go and how long does it take?
You know, that it varies and it depends on how busy you are and how many roadblocks you hit and how fussy you are. I had no artistic training because I was strong musically. When I was 10, I was pulled out of art class to play in the band, which wasn't what I wanted to do. But that was forced upon me.
Yeah.
And so I haven't had an art class since I was 10. So everything I learned about 3D CAD, about how curves interrelate, it was just from just staring at them, trying to figure it out.
Doing it.
And so that bass on the wall there, it's a traditional bass, but I redrew it 3 times over a period of 2 years, just trying to get everything aligned, everything to flow together. And I mean, it's a pre-existing shape. I didn't have to create it. So it could take months or it could take years. To really dial it in, I think, is more in the case of years, for me at least.
And also because the electronics, the pickups are also like angled.
Yes.
Is that because of the length of the scale, right?
Yes. So they would be lined up with harmonics. And years and years ago, a friend of mine studied the different relationships, and he worked it out as percentages. I put it in my phone back then. Well, it was a Palm Pilot back then, and I still refer to it. You know, precision is a certain percentage of the scale length, and a jazz is a certain percentage, 60s or 70s, depending on where the bridge placement is.
Do you ever like challenge those numbers?
Yes. Yes. So if you look at the bridge pickup on that, I have no idea what the relationship is. It was moved tonally. And so pickups, when you test them, you can test them by themselves and try and find a position that you like. But then if there's two pickups, how do they interact?
Yeah.
And, you know, 3 millimeters will change the mid enough that you will notice. And so it became a case of listening to it soloed, listening to it blended. We do both series and parallel. So now you have 2 combinations that have to work together.
Yeah.
And so positioning becomes very, very a trial and error.
Yeah. So how long does that process take?
You know, if you sit down and concentrate and you have an instrument that you've prepared with a big space that you can move the pickup wherever you want, it can go relatively quickly. So maybe an afternoon and you'd have it dialed in.
It's like, okay, this is the sweet spot.
Yes, yes.
But is it something, because I mix a lot of my own records and I can do it in like an afternoon, but I can also do it in 3 weeks, you know, because it's never done.
Yes, yes,
Am I trusting my ears good enough?
Yes.
Is that something that goes for this also?
It's 100%. Especially with pickup design, because pickup design, at least in my experience, you wind a pickup and it's like a new baby and it's like, wow, that's amazing. That's incredible. It's perfect. We're done.
Yeah.
And then the next day it's like, you know what? I it's not as magical as I remember. We better wind another one.
Yeah.
And that can go on and on and on and on. So dozens and dozens and dozens of pickup prototypes.
What kind of bass player do you have in mind when building like a new bass? Is there like, I'm building it for this kind of player, or
no?
Do you like always do it for your own ears?
Own ears. Mm-hmm. However, that may change, because I had an interesting experience. We've been building basses for 30 years, 30 plus years. Very specific tone in mind. And I saw you too. So there's another Dutch connection.
The drummer now.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Amazing drummer. So had a chance to meet Adam Clayton, had a chance to see them at the Las Vegas Sphere, which was absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Oh, the technology is incredible. And the band was incredible. They rehearse like it's their first gig. Every day they'll rehearse, sometimes for hours before a show. Anyhow, that was the first time I'd really paid attention to Adam's playing and his tone. And I finally got it, that the only way the Edge can do what the Edge does is to have somebody like Adam below holding everything together. And it was like a master class in solid bass.
Yeah.
And that changed my thinking about bass tone. And so, yeah, now we're going to be adding capabilities of that tone into our basses.
And if you explain that more, what kind of things sonically are you then looking for?
Sonically, it was very rolled off. Mostly low frequencies, and we've focused on the harmonics. Bass players tend to talk about this bass has a great fundamental. Well, in my opinion, every bass has great fundamental. A rubber band on a box has great fundamental. Mm. The fundamental kind of takes care of itself. But if you listen to pure bass frequencies, like in 20 hertz, 40 hertz, man, you can barely hear anything. Mm-hmm. It's the harmonics that carry all the information that as a human you'd interpret as pitch or as a musical information. And so we've always focused on that end of things. And with longer scale, the harmonics become more in tune with the fundamental and the information becomes, I mean, we have two tiny eardrums that are trying to process every single vibration in the air. So what we've done is we've tried to make that information as clear as possible so that it cuts through and it mixes as easy as possible.
Tight.
Yeah. Tight bass mix is much easier than big woofy bottom bass.
Yeah.
But there's room for big woofy heavy bottom bass in a more sparse mix and it can fill things up. So that the guitar player can be free to not have to do rhythm all night to be able to create that end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like a new perspective you got from the gig out of the sphere. For
yes.
You too.
100%. Yeah.
Wow. Looking forward to those new basses then in the future.
I am too. It, and because we've spent so much time working on getting the second and third harmonics lined up with the fundamental, we've got that covered.
Hmm.
And now when we add this, now we've just opened up and created a whole new palette of colors that doesn't take away from the palette of colors that we already had.
Are you already busy in that process trying to find out?
Yeah. It's a simple fix. I haven't had a chance to experiment with it yet, but we've done it enough times that I'm confident that we can do it easily.
Let's talk about the new product line, the Dingwall Super P.
Yes.
It was just made as a custom shop previously, right?
Exactly.
And now it's going into production. Can you tell something about it?
Yeah, I mean, probably 10 years people have been asking for a production version of the Super P. When you make things by hand, especially at a very high level, it doesn't matter who you are, you have to work slowly. And because we don't build thousands of instruments, you never gain the job rhythm to be able to do very clean work fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so building instruments slowly in North America or Europe, it's expensive. We all have to eat at shop for the same groceries, pay the same money for gas, pay the same rent. And so good art is expensive.
Yeah.
But musicians live in a world where their competition, for a large degree would do it for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's a second currency that nobody talks about, and that's the currency that feeds your soul. And, as an artist, that means everything. To have this soul-filling currency. Mm-hmm. And so if you play a gig for free, you still feel fulfilled, although maybe your stomach's empty.
Mm-hmm.
Very few lawyers practice for free.
If you just call them, they will send you a bill.
Yes, exactly. and so that's a completely different spectrum where they focus on more on paper currency versus soul currency. And so the only way to lower the cost of an instrument is either lower the quality of materials or lower the quality of labor or both. We come from a custom shop world and our values, they just don't align with lowering the quality of materials.
Mm.
And so we're left with lowering the cost of labor, which we go offshore to manufacturing partners who have access so they can They can pay a decent wage relative to their area, and then they would do 90% of the work. We ship the instruments back to Canada, and we have a team that does the last 10%. And it's just like in anything, the final 10% is the most expensive.
Yeah.
Because that's where you need all the precision and the refinement. Hmm. And so, yes, the SP-1 will make its debut towards the end of this year. And 2 years in refining the design, and then the last piece of the puzzle was creating pickups that took us in a new direction that we'd never been before. And we had to go outside of traditional pickup making to create something that sounds traditional.
Yeah. And you found it.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. Now, this is a whole new horizon that we can explore.
Yeah, great. I was also wondering, a bass amp is very important for the sound.
Yes.
I heard that the Dark Glass new combos are going to be released. The 500 watts 210 and the 112 analog and digital. And you have like an interesting relationship with Dark Glass, I heard.
Dark Glass is an interesting company. Started by Douglas Castro, and the story he told me was that Dark Glass came from people just mixing up his name and of Douglas, and he started from nothing, and he's completely self-taught. When I first met him, he didn't even look like he was out of high school yet. And he was building bass distortion pedals. And I thought, why would you want a bass distortion pedal? And of course, if you solo, a lot of classic rock bass tracks, the bass is usually saturated and it just works better in the mix that way. So Douglas was onto something long before anybody else. And in my opinion, he's an absolute genius, a genius designer. Franco, who does his industrial design work for him, is also a genius. And so we've worked together separately. We came together to work on a single project back in 2013 with Adam and Ollie Getgood to create a bass that used Dark Glass Electronics. Had Adam's input and then Dingwall Bass. And that was the first time we worked together. And it was basically like sitting at a table. We all went for breakfast together at NAMM and we bounced around ideas. Doug handled the electronics end of things. I dug my feet in and it was my position that, you know, the world has enough three-band EQs, and we don't need another three-band EQ. What's the point? How can we do something different? And eventually, that led to a gentleman named Mark Stickley. He was having a conversation at the other end of the table, and he went, you know, it's a bass. Why do you need a treble? And I went, oh, wait a minute. If we don't need a treble, that frees up one of the controls to be a high mid. Hmm. And so Adam was sitting next to me, and I said, Adam, what would you think about this? What would you think about no treble, just bass, low mid, high mid? And Adam went, yeah, that'd be perfect. Doug was sitting at the other end of the table. Doug, what do you think of this? And Adam, what frequencies would you choose? And he conveyed that to Doug, and Doug just sort of got a blank look on his face for 10 seconds. And he went, yeah, I can do it.
Cool.
And that became, that was in Disneyland, and that became, you know, one of the most used preamps in heavy music in the last 10 years.
Wow. Yeah. Talking about heavy music, you guys have been endorsing a couple of big heavy bass players.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about Adam Nolly Getgood from Periphery.
Yes.
Jacob Umansky, Kyle Conkiel.
Yeah.
Earl Pereira, Gary Lalonde. The list goes on and on. John Taylor, Duran Duran.
Yeah.
And Leland Sklar. Talking about legends.
Leland is, he's the most amazing guy in the world. Just as a human, I know nobody better. And as a bass player, again, Leland is so talented that you almost don't notice it because nothing sticks out as being out of place. Hmm. And yet, the reason he's been on 2,000 albums is because he can just go in and in one take, maybe two takes for safety, nail it. And
how did you guys meet up? How did he become an endorsing artist?
I had to go to the washroom. It was our first NAMM, and so it's like Ralph Novak and I shared a booth, and Charlie Hunter played at that booth, which was amazing. I'd never heard him, and I never forgot that performance. Mm-hmm. But I had to go to the washroom, and so I left the booth, went around the corner, and almost bumped right into Lee Sklar. And again, this is one of those things where you like somebody immediately. And Lee can't get through NAMM without somebody saying, Lee, can you try my bass? Lee, can you try my bass? Lee, can you try my bass? And normally he'll say no. But this one time, the relationship just sort of right from the get-go, we just liked each other. And he thought, oh, okay, I'll give this a try. Brought him back to the booth. He tried the bass and spent probably an hour there talking and playing, and went, okay, sure, yeah, I'd love to take one into the studio. So we built one, we sent it to him, and he recorded an album with Brian Wilson, yeah,
the Beach Boys.
Yeah, so that was the first album he recorded, was one of Brian Wilson's albums.
Wow.
That was on a Friday. Monday he calls up and says, I'm in. Whatever you want, I'll be an artist, I'll endorse, whatever you want. But
that's like a massive compliment.
Huge. Yeah, huge. He said, there's only one thing. The frets are too big. Could you make me one with mandolin frets?
Mandolin frets.
And I'm like, wait.
What?
What? Because I came from the guitar world, 80s shred, and you know, the biggest frets were not big enough. And mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, it's a bass, so it needs even bigger frets. And again, having one of those clear memories from, this was 30 years ago, but it seemed like yesterday. It's that clear in my mind. Built another bass for Lee. I thought, okay, I'll put mandolin frets in, set it up. And the first time I played it, it was just like magic. Same neck. Everything was the same. And yet the neck felt much more slender, easier to play. You could slide up and down the neck and it wasn't clack, clack, clack. It was note, 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 note. Really interesting. Wow. And so the bass before that one for Lee was the last bass we ever used large frets on. From that, it was just like, okay, we're never using large frets again. We hung them on the wall, and I don't know what happened to them, but they never went into a bass again.
He switched the mandolin frets due to Lee Sklar.
Yeah, 100%. Mandolin frets are tiny. Mm-hmm. So we went one size up from that, which would be banjo size or Martin acoustic size.
Did you tell him?
On his, they're always mando.
Yeah.
But on everything else, to make it more production friendly and more friendly for customers who would be afraid of mandolin frets.
It's very specific.
Very specific. Mm-hmm. And if you make too much of a change, and this is coming from a guy who makes multi-scale basses in funny colors. if you make too much of a change, it scares people. And some people, you know, have about roughly half the population have an adventurous open mind, and the other half of the population are more risk averse, and change scares them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how people work.
Yeah,
yes.
We need both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And other artists that are like John Taylor from Duran Duran, how is it to work with a legend like him?
Kind of intimidating, actually, because I'm, you know, I grew up in the Duran Duran era, and I was a fan of the band, and we used to play Duran covers in my band. Hmm. And so to actually get a call from his tech and saying, you know, John would like to try on your basses, it was like, are you serious? I thought it was a prank. Hmm. And once we figured out that, no, it's not a prank. He's in Canada. We have one day to ship a bass to him. We just dropped everything. And we put a bass together, set it up for him, broke every speed limit on the way to the FedEx office,
yeah.
Got in 1 minute before 5, and we got it into his hands. It was a slow process of him adjusting to the bass. Like, he got the bass right away, but you know, when you're playing in front of 2,000 people, 10,000 people, you do need to put the best performance on that you can.
And you need to get acquainted with your instrument.
Yes, and so that took several years, but it was a slow and steady process, and eventually it got to the point where the process led to him saying, you know, I'd like to talk to you about a signature model. And so I flew out to London, and we had a meeting at his rehearsal space. And so I got to see all the
cool,
the inside gear, and then like the stuff they collected, and it's eclectic and cool. But in parallel with that, in 1995, I had a conversation with a Nashville session guy, and he was talking about how in Nashville, it was the thing at the time was to take a Rupert Neve recording console,
yeah,
pull a strip out, and turn it into a rack unit. And I thought, why would you do that? And he said, oh, because they just sound amazing. And from that conversation, I was just like, wow, wouldn't it be cool to work with Rupert Neve someday and create a bass preamp? Man, I would ever love to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm little dingwall in Canada. They wouldn't even take my phone call. And I felt that way until the John Taylor signature. And then it was like, oh, well, now maybe we have an artist that they would go, yeah, we'll work with you. So we thought, let's give it a try. It turns out that their entire engineering team are bass players. And they'd never done an onboard bass preamp before. So it was like, oh, this could be fun. So we worked it out, and I gave them some specs and some guidance. And when I say that, loose specs, loose guidance, just from the perspective of how long do we want the batteries to last and things like that, and what frequencies roughly are we looking for. They did everything else. Those guys are magicians. They sent us a single prototype, and like within seconds, it was just like, there's magic. Hmm. Whatever's going in is coming out sounding better, even before you adjust the EQ. And I don't know how they did it. They didn't use measuring techniques. It was all ears. And so they built the general circuit, and then they ordered in every appropriate op amp that they thought might work.
Yeah.
Probably a dozen. And then they additioned op amps.
Tried which one worked best.
Different manufacturers. Which one sounds the sweetest?
With the John Taylor signature bass at that time.
It wasn't a signature bass then. This was just the preamp portion of it.
Yeah.
And once we had that, then we approached John and said, listen, we've been working with Neve. And John's initial idea was he wanted to have a signature bass for the anniversary of the Rio album. And guess what console they recorded the Rio album on?
I think a Neve.
It was. And so he was like, Neve? Yeah. Oh, that'd be perfect.
Yeah.
Cool. And so we had to pull a lot of strings to make everything happen. But we got that Neve into John's bass, and then feedback from Bernie, his tech. John has a very specific playing style, and Bernie was asking, you know, could you make these modifications to the knobs to work with John so that it would just work better.
Yeah.
And from that, I kind of did a U-turn, and instead of going with a three-band preamp, went with, we typically have five knobs. And the first three knobs I turned into a passive system. We've never really, on our active basses, never really used a passive tone. Mm-hmm. Never really. I couldn't wrap my mind around having two treble controls. Mm-hmm. So I had to work it out that it's not a treble control, it's a tone control. And over here is your treble control. And so we played with the tone of the capacitors to change the tone of the tone control to work in harmony with the treble control. So they sound different. And that led to the ability to interact between the passive tone and the active treble. Yeah. And the Neve treble is so quiet, you can pin it on 10 and there's no hiss.
No.
And so now you have this wonderful opportunity to just have this magical sort of interplay between the two controls.
And I think he was happy with it, John.
His exact quote was, "This is the best sounding bass I've ever recorded." And his engineer and producer, who won a Grammy for Uptown Funk, he worked on that song.
Yeah, Mark Ronson.
Mark Ronson worked with Josh Blair. Josh Blair was the engineer.
The engineer, yeah.
Ronson was the producer.
Producer, yeah.
And so, yeah. And Mark Ronson actually works with Duran Duran quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's a small world. Yeah. Are there any artists that you would like to have as an endorsing artist? Are there any artists on your wish list, or is that something that just happens?
It kind of just happens. To answer your question, Sting would be a first choice. My expectation of that happening is probably zero chance.
Maybe he's watching. Sting, if you're watching, give it a try, man. Come on. Yeah, why not?
Geddy Lee would be awesome. He's a fellow Canadian. I'm not even sure he's aware of us, but I've always been a fan of Geddy. I'm sure there are more, and I'm probably forgetting somebody very important, but those are the first two names that come to mind.
About the future, what is like the future for Dingwall Guitars?
Well, it's interesting that the world is in such an upheaval now, it seems, and I think everybody's kind of scratching their heads going, what's going on? Culturally, it's been good for us. The worst thing for us was the retro trend that happened sort of late 90s. That just took the wind out of our sails. We almost went out of business.
Okay.
You know, most trends last 5 years or so, you know. How long did New Wave last? How long did Disco last? You know,
grunge.
Yeah, grunge, yeah, yeah. 5 years.
5 years and it's gone.
Yeah. retro, man, it just never seemed to quit. And it's just, in the last couple of years, gone away for us, at least. And so I think this turmoil is maybe forcing people to look to the future and going, you know, let's make a better future. And so for us, that fits perfect, because what have we been about forever? Let's make a better future.
Let's make a better bass guitar.
Yeah.
Better music, better, everything better. Like, stuck
no
in the past.
No, I'm as I get older, I'm learning a greater respect for the past. I was guilty of not respecting the past when I was younger and more arrogant, and but now I hopefully have lost a little bit of arrogance and am ready to learn and grow more. So far, the guitar industry, the bass industry, traditionally, since COVID, took off like crazy during COVID. And then after COVID, it was like a ball falling off a table.
Yeah.
And but for us, the growth is still unbelievable. Like, I'm scratching my head going, this can't be happening. And yet our sales are almost doubling at this point.
Is it probably due to like Instagram, TikTok? I see a lot of clips of talented people trying to stretch the limits, sometimes even of human capacity playing, but also on instrument use. Is it something you are looking at or seeing that same trend? Maybe that boosts sales?
Yeah. Do you remember in the 80s when it was all about shred guitar and, mm-hmm. and everybody was trying to outdo themselves with technique? And we noticed the same thing with the bass guitar in the last 10 years. Not to the same degree, but the bass player went from being sort of this forgotten guy in the back that
serving.
Yes. And that's still an important role, mm-hmm. but added to that is a more upfront bass player with a more upfront tone. And in the last 10 years, bass has changed. You know, for not a lot of money, you can buy a really nice home audio system that has great bass. And so in the history of listening to music, it's never been as accessible to the average listener. And without knowing it, their ears have been getting a better education in quality audio than in any point in history. So the average listener has higher expectations. The sound systems are better capable at producing bass. And so we've been quietly working away in the background, working on a better source tone for bass.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, our strategy was during the retro years where it was really, we were struggling was, oh, if we just do it better, maybe we'll attract more customers, and just do it better, we'll attract more customers. And so we just kept trying to do better and trying to do better. And so when we actually did start to connect with more musicians, we already had something that had 20 years of really hard work and refinement in it.
You already put the labor in.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. And you started with electric guitars.
Yep.
You are essentially an electric guitar player yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any chance that you will make Dingwall electric guitars again?
You know, I think so. We have guitar designs on the drawing board now. The problem is we have over 3 years of custom work ahead of us. We have 3 years worth of people waiting on custom orders.
Well,
Even on the production instruments, we call them ready to play, but they'll be ready in a year kind of thing. So it would be an insult to those customers for me to direct any of my energy towards a guitar instead of working on trying to get them their basses to them quicker. Mm. So, you know, in the future, but not in the very, very near future.
No. When there's time at hand,
yeah.
You're like, what should I do? Okay, let's make a guitar.
Exactly.
Sheldon, I always end this podcast with you meeting your younger self.
Mm.
And you have one question, or you have one advice you can give to your younger self. What would that be?
Dude, don't stress so much.
Famous last words. Thank you very much, Sheldon, for coming
thank
here.
You so much.
Thank you very much. And thank you for listening and watching this episode of Guitar Man, the podcast with Sheldon Dingwall. If you like what you've seen and heard, please don't hesitate. Subscribe to my YouTube channel to get more guitar-related content in the near future. And leave a message in the comments because I'd like to know what you think about this episode. See you in the next video. Bye.